The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. On the previous episode, the legendary Rick Priestley joined Jason and Mark for a conversation about narrative wargaming, and I'm delighted to say that the chaps are back today for part two. Let's get straight into it. Here's Jason.
Well, Rick, can I ask you a couple of other questions then, just about gaming in general? Just because behind all this is this general philosophy about how we have our attitudes towards it. And you're saying how we were all lost little creatures who were living in sunless environments in the past that used to play these things. And I feel like the culture has turned on its head, but so is socializing. This is now one of the most social things that can be done. Yep. Within the modern culture.
Yeah.
And anyone's coming along if you're willing to open up to it.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, there are certain things that I've heard you and some other of your compatriots say in the past, like no points and things like that. Is there such a thing as balance? Because the most fun games I've had have had no semblance of balance, like playing out a 300 scenario or playing a siege. The imbalance is the point.
Yeah, well, when you say balance, I mean, what is your measure? What is your measure? What is the thing that's balanced? I mean, see, if it's people enjoying themselves, everyone having a good time, then the game's balanced, isn't it? And that might be dependent to some extent upon things you introduce during the game. But in terms of a competition, points values give you a rough sort of a rough balance, if you like. But they're never going to be any more than that, unless you play on exactly the same tabletop every time, that it's symmetrical in every respect, so it's not favouring one side or another. And that the way the armies are presented means every army is equal to every other army. Which, say, if you've got an army that's basically I'll stand here and be a gun line, it's just as good as against an army that's we'll go in and attack fast with brutal savagery, or we'll dance around and shoot a lot, or we'll stand here and have a gun line as well. You've got to be equal against all those things. It just never happens. It's not possible. I don't think it's possible. What we always strove to do with points values were a means of allowing people to assemble armies and collections. That's the primary purpose of a points values. It's nothing to do with game balance as such, but you want people to have a good time, so you make sure that as far as possible, if you've got 1,000 points and you've got 1,000 points, you're going to have a game of some sort.
So the goal, again, is the game rather than actually having something that's chess-like that you're trying to beat your opponent, even with that sense. Is the metaculture even sure what balance is then? Because everyone uses it left, right, and centre, saying, oh, this game was balanced, this game's balanced. But I don't actually know what they mean, because you've exposed some of my misunderstandings there about what do I mean by balance. I honestly don't know.
Well, they'll tend to mean is that if they're competitive gamers, they'll look at every single army list, and they don't just buy their own army list, they buy all the army lists, or they make sure they've got copies of all the army lists. And that whichever army you choose, if you go through, and if you're a competitively minded player, you'll work out how effective each troop type is for its points value, and effective might depend upon a tactic, and then you'll maximize that tactic and that value within the army. They call it min-maxing, don't they? And then if you do that for every single army, and then take those specific builds, those iterations of the army, and play them all against each other, theoretically, if you're all of a similar, if you're of a similar level of competitive play, i.e. determined to win at all costs, then your chances of winning are 50-50. I mean, that's pretty much how it works. But some of those builds and some of those armies are going to be so nasty. They're almost going to be, you know, whether you've won or you've lost as soon as the tables, turn one, as soon as you put the toy soldiers down.
That's happened to me.
Yeah, yeah. And what's the point in that? Where's the joy in that, eh? Brian, that's all you should say.
Well, it leaves me curious to it because Dryan Ansel's madness in his books that you typed up, I believe. I've been using them as really good game aids just to go, oh, that's an interesting idea. That one thing out of this 20,000, that one thing, I'm going to drop that in my game today. And it's been a lovely little resource. But the competitive side of things, I'm just wondering how to make a bridge for those players. So they could, well, I can always make it like, okay, I know you do this sort of thing, but I promise you guys, if you come at it from this, it'd be a nice little salad for you.
And yeah, I think the answer there is make it possible to drop in and drop out. And just do what you do as well as you can and make sure it's as entertaining as it can be. And then that's up to them, isn't it? I don't think... giving them the opportunity is about as good as it gets. I don't think you can... If people are of a particular... You know, if their hobby really is that kind of competition wargaming, that, you know, I'm going to bring my 1,000 points and that's my collection, then you know, that's good for them, you know, that's fine. But I do what you do well. I think that's the answer.
Okay, no problem. Well, many of your games are I go, you go systems. And I've had lots of friends say, oh, it's not the optimal way of playing games these days. And I've been quite confused by it. And I've been wanting to take this opportunity to say, why do you like them? Because I know why I like them. But I wanted to check what you thought.
I go, you go. It's a term which we always used to say just alternating turns. I go, you go has become a little bit pejorative as a phrase. Yes. And it's really, what it is, when you build a game, you choose a system, you choose a basic core mechanic, a way of players interacting. And then you build it up on that, and you layer it up or whatever. If you choose an I go, you go, I go chess type system, alternating turns, that's fine so long as you've got the opportunity for players to interact within it, and you've got a relatively quick turnover. What happened is that a lot of Games Workshop games became very focused only on the active participant, to the extent that people were basically wandering off and going and getting a beer in their opponent's turn. That's the problem with it. It's, if you do it badly, you've got overcomplicated systems, you've got players isolated from the action because they're not having any opportunity to react, then it can leave a sour taste in people's mouths. And I think that's what's caused the problem. It's not that I go, you go is a bad way of organizing a war game. It's that if you create a badly constructed war game that's I go, you go, people think that's what I go, you go is. But it isn't. Does that answer the question?
Well, I'm interested because for the biggest of games that we've played so far, I like I go, you go when there's masses of people because it's a social event.
Yeah.
When it's the opponent's turn, you can switch off a little bit, ask about the models, ask about how your mate's doing, go and get some food, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's a really relaxed environment, and that's where it... Whereas if they were having to be hot on it the whole time, oh, are we going to interrupt now? Are we going to do this now? Are we going to...
Yeah.
It becomes quite frenetic, and no one's actually socialising.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You still, but in Warhammer, you still have to... You still have to take your saves, don't you? And you have to make your... Moral effects, if you're obliged to, and so, but
quite laid back though.
Yeah, that's the way we play Black Powder and Hail Caesar, you know, which are sort of I go, you go systems with activation within the turn. So they are essentially one side will take a turn, then the other side will take a turn. So it's I go, you go in that sense. And that's exactly how we play. So, you know, if it's your turn and you're actually rolling to move and then moving and firing, whatever. The other side will, particularly if the action's on the other side of the table, will generally have a conversation about something else, you know. Because, you know, we're all friends, but we don't meet up very often apart from when we war game.
Similarly,
it's a good opportunity.
Yeah. Well, for that, that would then make the negative of an IGO-UGO the strength.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with an IGO-UGO system. It's only a bad thing if it's done badly, where, you know, the turns are very, very long and people don't feel they've got any real interaction. And particularly if, as in some of these Games Workshop games, what you're doing is so almost like game winning within an instant. If you're just sat there watching your army being destroyed, feels very, and that's it, you go, okay, have I lost now? Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm interested. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I like it as a basic system. It's not something I'll ever give up on. The spaceship game I've just done that I was talking about, that's an IGO-UGO system. It's card-based, you know, it uses playing cards rather than dice, but it's entirely IGO-UGO. Bolt Action isn't. Bolt Action, the World War II game, is a unit activation. So yes. you draw, and if you play it, but you draw a chit or a dice, normally a coloured dice from a bag, and depending on who draws the chit, one side will go or the other side will go, just with one unit. And that's much more, that's quite a modern way of playing a game. It gives you a different dynamic, and it's actually very good way of playing a war game, and it's a very good way of playing a competitive war game. I don't think it works so well for the games that you do. I think the games that you do, the narrative-based ones, because they have an element of timing where you don't expect things to move out of sequence too much. So, say, for example, if you've got some archers covering the town square and somebody runs across the town square, you would expect your archers to notice and do something about it. Whereas in a chit drawing system, the guys could run across the town square and then run across the town square again if they got two moves, for example, without the archers ever getting a chance to move to do anything about it. Or the archers could have already taken their chit based turn and therefore the guys move across without doing anything about it. See, it's not, it doesn't give you that same narrative element, which breaks down into almost seconds. Now, within this 5-second period, everyone's going to do something. The next 5-second period, everyone will do something.
Okay. You know, so it depends what we want to show within the game, what we're trying to characterize.
Yeah, it's because it's much more real. It's much more based on a real, on what's really happening on the ground. It's that you're watching that Western movie, and it's got that pace where things happen, and people react to each other. Whereas in a lot of these slightly more abstract systems, particularly where they're chip-based or you're going unit at a time, you kind of have to stand, you have to kind of take an overview and look at it as a bit of an abstraction, which makes it work as a, very well as a war game, but I don't think it works as well as a on that same sort of individual level story, you know, the person on the ground.
Okay. So when people, for instance, I think I've heard various people, but the one that springs to mind is Mr. Chambers. He said he hates IGO-UGO and he thinks it's a flawed idea, full stop.
Yeah, I've had the conversation with him, and actually it's more a case of, because he's somebody who's trying to make a living writing war games rules, which is a very difficult thing to do.
I bet.
There's not that much money in the, he was saying to me that the problem with IGO-UGO was it was so unpopular it had fallen out of fashion that he just couldn't design an IGO-UGO system anymore.
Because people were automatically turned off to it.
Yeah. And that's because the people that are commissioning these games are all in the Games Workshop model. You know, they're all trying to create pseudo Games Workshop games. So there's a game called Trench Crusade, which is just been a big sort of thing. It's sort of crowdfunded. I think they crowdfunded themselves to about £5 million.
Well done.
It's really big. And Thomas Pirinen's the man behind it. And he was one of the Warhammer developers in the mid-90s. But I'm looking at it and it looks very, very Games Workshop. You know, the model is very Games Workshop. I suspect that'll be an iGoGoGo system.
Okay.
But we'll see. We'll see.
One of the things I wanted to ask Rick, which is kind of it's a bit of a strange point, is sometimes people say to us when we're saying, oh, we're running this game, today, they say, well, what game are you playing? And to us, the answer to that is, this is the story, this is what's going to be happening.
Yeah.
But to them, they mean, what edition of Warhammer are you playing, or what might it be? And we're often saying, well, for example, we use 6th edition because Jason has the greatest fluency with that. That's the one he grew up playing most. So as the games master, it makes perfect sense for him to have the one that's more accessible in his head. We use the 4th edition Magic set because it's great fun. We want to add that in. We're essentially doing a kind of homebrew approach because in some ways, sort of bizarrely, we're actually less interested in the system and more interested in what's happening on the table. And the system is simply a way to get to that end.
Yes.
I think that's kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? That people are very obsessed with what game are you playing, in the way that it might be a card game or a board game, where it's very important that you know the rules.
Yeah,
you can't play bridge against someone who's playing Canasta, and I understand that. But in this instance, you know, we're not worried about it. Jason's pretty relaxed about, you know, edge cases of rules and things like that. We're just kind of, there's quite a lot of hand waving that goes on, and not in a bad way.
Yeah. Well, even when we're playing something like Black Powder, which we do play quite a lot, there are often situations which come up where we go, oh, wait a minute, I think that's in the rule book. I'm not sure how it works. It's in the rule book. And somebody will go, yeah, I can't be arsed looking up in the rule book. Let's just do this. We'll do it.
That's me.
Yeah. Or we'll say, well, I'll tell you what, roll the dice for it. It's either this or this, roll the dice for it.
Mm.
And we'll do that. Because, you know, it's more important to keep the game going, and bearing in mind that, you know, chances are there's me, there's Jervis Johnson, we wrote Black Powder. We still don't. The funny thing is, if you write a set of rules, you don't necessarily carry them in your head in detail all the time, particularly if you've written similar sets or you play similar sets.
Mm.
So, you know, you're not necessarily as fluent as you might expect. But you kind of understand the principles. If you understand the principles behind it, then you can just riff off it, can't you?
I think so. And I think with the sheer amount of random elements that are going on anyway, I mean, you're dealing with random numbers in dice rolls, you're dealing with the friction between multiplayers, you know, different commanders, commander control problems, people not concentrating, people moving things accidentally.
Yeah.
None of it really matters. It's all about being true to the spirit of the game, really, rather than being pernickety about the rules.
Yeah, it is. Is it? There's something, it's a saying that's ascribed to Gary Gygax, but I don't know if it's true or not. Well, he said the only reason he actually used dice in his games because he liked the sound of them rolling across the table.
That's really interesting. And it's such a tactile hobby, isn't it? That is a nice part of it.
That's exactly it. He wasn't really interested in what score was going to have. And one to role-playing games master's trick is always to say, always to get the other player, you know, the player to go, roll the dice. They roll the dice, and then you look at the number and you look slightly surprised. And you go, oh. And then you look through your notes. And then you just make something up. It's kind of like just three.
I think that's what Jason's been doing this whole time.
Yeah,
no, players. It's very well structured. No, I don't make anything up.
But it's quite, because it gives that, it gives you the dice roll, it gives you the tension, it gives you the interest, and then
no one spots it, Rick. No one spots the sleight of hand.
Or if they do, they kind of look at you and you go, yeah, it's a gag, you know.
Have a biscuit.
Have a biscuit.
Well, I've got a couple of final thoughts that I'd love to get you just your opinion on in general. What for you have been some GM or DM moments that you've enjoyed best over your time, or that you've been in, maybe you've been in charge or you've been participant in?
I don't know. I tell you a very recent one. There's a friend of mine organised a war game via the internet, so we had cameras and so on and so forth. So he had the table, and it was a naval war game. So he had the table and he had the ships, and we could see what was going on. And me and my opponent were basically giving him instructions and telling him what to do and all that. And then we were rolling dice. But of course, we're rolling dice off camera. And my, and it was a D20 based system. And for three turns in a row, my opponent rolled 20. And we're all in the end going, yeah, yes, of course you've rolled a 20. Of course you've rolled a 20. And he gets the camera and he shows it. He did roll a 20. But it's that sort of extreme look, isn't it? Yes. And so consequently, the Bismarck got blown to smithereens in turn one again. That sort of thing.
We have had that recently as well. We loved our one. We've got a wizard called Jeff. As part of the Discord group, we've made this wizard called Jeff, who time and dimension jumps across anyway. I mean, sci-fi could be anywhere. And he's a bit of a rincewind via quantum leap. And this random table has got split into two. Oh, dear, one of them is now evil.
Right.
It's like a mitosis thing. Well, that happened four times in a row. Yeah. What do you do now? You've got eight of the buggers.
Yeah, we can get that. I think some of the tables that Brian Ansell, he kind of invented and then I extended them, worked them up. They ended up in Realm of Chaos, which you've probably got a copy of. Slaves to Darkness, I think. And it's a D1000 chart. And the D1000 chart has all these mutations in it. But some of those combinations are just hilarious.
I love them. I have got them. Yeah. I've used them. Well, what's been a best gaming experience that you think you've had? What's the kind of setting that you think is your thing best? Or are you a bit of a salad guy? Do you like competitive or do you prefer something in particular?
No, I prefer the big multiplayer games, which are kind of like get together with some mates. You've got some biggish armies and you play a game that's got a fairly simple narrative these days because, you know, there'll be six of us and we don't get together that often. And it's the joy of pushing the toy soldiers around and rolling dice and talking nonsense that I think I really enjoy these days more than anything. I don't really get a chance to play the sort of narrative games that you guys are playing. Because, as I say, we're a bit different. I mean, it's like the Perrys are deeply into their Napoleonic games. I have a few other people I know who are who play big ancients games with Hail Caesar in the same sort of style. But I don't know anyone who plays the sort of strong narrative games that you're describing. See, the last time I did anything like that was with Warlords of Erewhon, which is a kind of a skirmish war game, warband-based war game, really. And it was with Nick Simerson, who runs Eureka Miniatures. And I'd kind of set up the story, and it was like an undead wizard who was bringing forth a chaos undead army within this ancient necropolis.
Nice.
And I took my high elves, and the high elves basically had to root out this wizard from this necropolis. It wasn't a terribly sophisticated sort of thing, but
evocative though.
Yeah, and it had that sort of narrative element to it. But there was only the two of us, so it ends up being a little bit of a straightforward game, even if you've got a story behind it. With some special rules to do with crossing the river that was between the necropolis and the high elves, where you didn't know quite what was going to happen. So I sort of constructed a rough table on the fly to give you some random results about whether you could cross or not, or whether crossing... there might be undead things in the water and so on. You know, you get the idea.
I love
all that sort of stuff. And that was the last time we did it. And that was just before COVID. So that must have been a few years ago. You know, about 4 years ago. Yeah.
Well, I noticed in the last update on the Perry's Facebook thing, or a couple of updates ago, that they did have some elements in there that were quite fun to see. Like they had, even though you say they're quite interested in their historics mostly, is that right? They don't really do the fantasy or the...
But they can still have those narrative elements in them.
Like a balloon, I think I saw, and no one knew what it was for, is that right?
That's right, yeah, the balloon, no one knew. That's exactly, yeah, that sort of thing. We played a samurai game where the whole idea behind the game was that a princess, I think, this is actually based on a historical event, a princess and her entourage have basically got to go along the table towards the castle at the end. So Alan Perry, he'd worked out sort of like a very snaking route from one end of the table to the other, which is, say, about 12 feet. And there were a few little villages along the way. And there were some peasants in the field. And they were being pursued. So they had to get to the castle before the princess got captured. And you were warned that there might be some assassins on the way. So some of these figures, these peasants, were in fact ninja, but you didn't know which ones it was. And so immediately you've got a narrative war game. And we played that out, and the guys came out from the castle to try and rescue them. They fought off the bandits who were trying to capture the princess. The princess, she's in a palanquin or a wagon, as I remember. And she's gradually making her way there. And a bodyguard's getting killed off, you know, this sort of thing. The ninja leaps out and gets cut down, and so on and so forth. Eventually, I think she just got there in time. She's almost like staggers through the fortress gates.
Oh, they're the best endings.
And there you go. And that probably is a narrative war game, isn't it? And there were quite a few.
It feels like it.
Yeah. But that was with the Perrys. But we were using, I can't remember whether it was Black Powder or Hail Caesar. Probably using Hail Caesar for that as the core game. But even within Hail Caesar, you see, with that princess going along the road, you have to have a strict rule that goes every turn she goes 12 inches. You can't do a roll to see whether she moves or not. In Hail Caesar, you'd normally make a roll to see how far something moved, whether it moved. And you can't, that's exactly what I was saying earlier, you can't do that in a narrative structure. You have to have that predictability, which we just, you know, accommodated.
Yeah.
So it was good fun.
I think you said the game that you're most proud of making yourself was War Master, is that right?
Yeah, as a game system, I think that's... it's something I did entirely myself. I say that, I mean, I did have help, it was kind of like I was the lead design and chief designer for it. Whereas everything else I've done over the years, 40K and Warhammer, have been like very collaborative efforts. And even though... You know, there are versions of Warhammer I pretty much did from scratch, particularly 4th edition. Other people have taken it over, and the game that it is today isn't the game I wrote. So, yeah, though I'm quite proud of 40K and Warhammer, obviously, I don't feel that personal connection I do with Warmaster, because Warmaster is very much a personal project. And that's why I quite enjoyed doing Lord of the Rings strategy battle game as well. I was quite proud of that.
One of my favourites.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting system. So I really stripped it back. I tried to create a game there that someone could play if they'd never played a war game before.
It worked. It was the second game, unfortunately, though, because my wife, I've been trying, over COVID, I tried to get her involved, as many forlorn husbands tried during COVID, I think. And the game that she entered most easily was Dungeon Saga by Jake Thornton. But the second game that she, as a level up, was your Lord of the Rings. And she hated Warhammer. She questioned my parentage and all sorts at the end of that session. It was an awful experience for her, for someone trying to step in. But the Lord of the Rings was something she got on board with as a second step.
I thought it worked out really well. I mean, again, I handed that over to Alessio Cavatore from the second version onwards, and he built it up, and it then got turned into a artwork, which was fantastically successful. So that was all very good.
What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show.
Well, I wanted to ask you on what your most, the happiest work you've done with, because I wanted to lead you on to what you would recommend from other people that you've seen. So other designers, what have you seen that you think is that something special? I thought that was great. And just to give them a shout out sort of thing, something that you'd like to put us onto.
Toy soldier based war games.
I'm not really worried. Whatever you think. If you want to give two examples, if you think there's a board, if you should differentiate between board games and toy soldiers, whatever you'd like.
Yeah, we've been playing lots of board games recently and sort of dragging old games up from the past. And one game which we played a few weeks ago, which I I've always really liked, but it's difficult to play because you need at least three and preferably four or five people, or even six to play it. And that's called Warlord or The Warlord. Different versions of the game were titled either The Warlord or Warlord. And it was produced in the late, sort of mid to late 70s, as a sort of a, by a chap who was a student originally. And it got picked up by Games Workshop and turned into a game called Apocalypse. And Apocalypse was a slightly scaled down version of Warlord. You can pick up copies of Apocalypse fairly easily. Warlord's quite difficult to get to this day.
Right.
But it's actually a risk. It's similar to Risk. So you get a map of the world, map of Western Europe and going out into Western Asia. And it's divided up into areas, and the areas will give you resources depending on how many of each area type you've got. And you build up armies and you fight. And as you fight and take over territories, you gain atomic bombs, obviously. And you build these atomic bombs in one of your territories, and then you shoot them at each other gradually over time. And as you shoot the atomic bombs off, they cause nuclear devastation and take areas out of the map. And it's just a very, very clever game. Simple, but the basic mechanic is that when you make an attack, you can only attack with the number of armies you've got or fewer. So if I've got, say, 10 armies in a place and I'm attacking another area, I get a dice and I hide it behind my hand and I put a number down. And it's 1 to 6. And that's all you can attack with, 1 to 6. The other guy guesses. If he guesses correctly, you lose that many armies. If he doesn't guess correctly, he loses one army. So you carry on like that. And then when he's only got one army left, the number you put down, if he doesn't guess it, he loses his piece. And you go into his territory with that number of pieces. So you've got to kind of double guess all the time. And of course, you naturally think nobody's going to risk 6 because you lose 6 armies. So I'll choose a low number. And the other guy's thinking, well, he's going to choose a low number because he doesn't want to risk 6. So I'll choose a low. See, you get that thing? So the interaction is very clever. And there are some various little fiddles, like you can only choose certain values when you attack a city. You can't choose a 1. You can choose 2 numbers when you go from sea to land. You can only choose 1, 2, 3 when you go to a mountain, that sort of thing. Yeah, that's a great game. If you manage to get hold of a copy, I'd very much recommend that.
Well, you've got my mind whirring now with that idea. Would that work as a campaign mechanism in between games? Can you use these armies? Can you get that territory? What game is a? Would that be a bit boring, do you think, in between?
I think it's a bit more. There's perhaps not enough kind of detail in it for that. What the game have we used for campaigns? There's a game based on the Waterloo campaign. I can't remember what it's called. It might be Napoleon at War or something. We use that as a campaign system for Napoleonic games. And it's basically about having armies and moving them from one along a road and 1 space, 2 space, 3 spaces kind of thing. Not a million miles away from the old Mighty Empires thing that I did all those years ago.
Yeah. So, which I've just got on my stairs coming in the door the other day because someone recommended that to me as a campaign mechanism.
It's a bit too complicated, really. But I fell into that trap of going, you've got to sell someone a campaign system. So you can't sell someone a blank piece of paper and go, here are some ideas. You've got to kind of do a lot of work and calculation, probably more than you really need to run a campaign.
So if I stripped it back, took some elements maybe and used it as a map.
I would take it as inspiration rather than as a word of God, you know. But we did play it as a board game quite a lot in the studio at one time.
Oh, nice.
Because it plays either way. You can either play it as a board game or you can play it as a campaign system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was quite good. Other than that, I'm a bit. Of course, most of the games I play, I've written.
Oh, of course. So would you recommend Hail Caesar, but a fantasy version? When are we getting that?
Oh, Hail Frodo.
Yes, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I did start doing that at one time a day, and then I thought, you know, it'd be a lot of work. And my problem with fantasy is I don't really know people who play fantasy. The thing is, because most of my gaming buddies are people that have worked for Games Workshop, in some cases still work for Games Workshop, but most cases have worked for Games Workshop, they're kind of just a little bit worn out on fantasy and science fiction.
Is there a recommendation you'd put for people then if they wanted to do something with your Hail Caesar? Because I enjoy your Hail Caesar. Warlord Games HQ introduced me to it when I went to visit them with their skeletons. Made a massive skeleton army. And I really wanted to do fantasy in it. But there was no ideas in there of how to do it with fantasy other than making it direct translations of historic army, if you see what I mean. So, would you have any recommendations for us?
Yeah, well, what I did was I made a bit of a start on it. I started writing up a scenario based on a sort of Irish folklore where you've got the Firbolg, which were kind of sort of demonic.
And then, I don't know then.
Yeah, it's sort of in the, you know, if you go back to sort of Irish folklore and you've got the tales of sort of Fianna and the warband, the sort of warband, Finn McCool, isn't it, and Cahullan, that sort of thing. A lot of fantasies based on those Irish legends, the Book of Invasions and things like that.
Okay.
It was sort of based around that idea, but I didn't really get very far with it. So I ended up with a lot of notes and a lot of ideas for magic and a lot of ideas for extending things from historical into fantasy. And what I did was I kind of took all those ideas and I put them in Warlords of Erewhon, the skirmish based fantasy game I did.
Yeah.
So really the magic system that I included in Warlords of Erewhon was the one I was going to use for Hail Frodo.
Okay.
There's a bit in there, and in fact, I could do it the other way around. I could now go and just take the text I did for Hail Caesar and work back all those elements from Warlords of Erewhon into that.
So if we got a copy of Warlords of Erewhon and made ourselves familiar, we might be able to just do a quick.
I think it would suggest you'd see that you would probably recognize the. Because obviously, you have to take some things from Hail Caesar as special rules and put them in Warlords of Erewhon. So you'll probably see that where I've done it. Let me think. I think Warlords of Erewhon is out of print, but Warlord Games wasn't all that interested in selling it, really. They're not really interested in fantasy because they're mates of mine, you see. That's why. But you can buy a digital copy.
Okay. Well, I am interested because what promoted Hail Caesar to me mostly was, although I enjoy Warhammer and mostly it's nostalgia and everything else that I enjoy Warhammer for, it was so much quicker and it didn't feel too different in terms of character with large armies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And it played quicker. And I thought because on my big narrative games days, people are traveling from all over Witchwear. And getting a game in within a day is quite key as a host, I feel, because sometimes we only get to turn three or four. So I was very keen to try and get something else going that was in your spirit of gaming, because it felt narrative enough. It was just at a different scale. It wasn't at the individual level, was it?
That's right. Yeah, no, it's unit-based. War game, but if you can still introduce all those narrative elements. It's not
easy.
If I remember right, when I did the original, Hail Caesar's gone to two editions. In the second edition, I wasn't real keen on doing it really, but I didn't do any of the, and I just revised the rules really just to make them clearer.
And then Warlord added in a lot of other stuff. But in the first edition, I did all the scenarios, and the scenarios often have a narrative element to them. So the, if I remember right, the Roman one is where Romans are raiding a rebel Celtic hill fort or tribal centre, but at the same time, that tribal leader is having a huge party, basically to celebrate something or other, possibly the wedding of his daughter. And little known to the Romans, that means that all these other war bands are converging on the tribal centre at the same time. And they have a lookout, if I remember right. The Celts have a lookout, so it's basically a hut on top of a tree. And a lot of the success of the Romans depends on whether they can, how far they can sneak down the table without being spotted by the guy in the tree. And as soon as the guy in the tree spots them, he sounds the alarm, and then things start to happen. And troops pour out of the tribal centre, whatever. And meanwhile, you're rolling dice to see if these other people turn up, just to see how many of the... So it becomes a question of whether the Romans realise in time that they're dealing with a lot more than they thought they were going to be dealing with, and then whether they can actually destroy the Celts one at a time, you know, in detail,
yeah,
rather than let them all assemble. So it's got a narrative element to it. And ideally multiplayer, because each of these tribal elements will be controlled by a different player.
So the only things left to do was the fantasy elements, like flyers, fire,
And monsters, which of course I did in Warlords of Erewhon. So although they're it's a different game system, it's based on bolt action actually. It still has stats, and it still has special rules, which deals with those things in a similar way. And as I say, the magic system I just ported over really.
How are you intending to keep the character of the undead in your just a brief mind's eye in the Hail Frodo? Did you have any thoughts on it? Because it can't be a new, because in Warhammer it's leader based, isn't it? The undead character, they're raising dead from their point of view, but the leaders are largely, they're not irrelevant, but they're very much more tokenistic, aren't they?
Yeah, I did it in a quite traditional way, if I remember right. So you do have you would have the ability to raise troops. And it's very important to have the necromancer controlling the troops. I don't recall in detail how I did it, but it would have been something very similar. I wasn't aiming to create, when I did Warlords of Erewhon, I wasn't aiming to do anything radical. I was trying to just create a game system that would allow people who had collected toy soldiers and got a bit of a Warhammer army, you know, Warhammer army collected in the 80s or 90s, just to get it out and play a game. You know, a little narrative war game with, you know, 30, 40, 50 figures. That was the idea behind it. So the army lists are very, I tried to make them generic, but I tried to make them such that if you've got a typical Warhammer army, you could easily fill it. Yeah. In fact, I did put a website together, what did I call it? I can't even remember now.
This Gaming Life, is that one?
Yeah, it might be This Gaming Life. Yeah, it was either This Gaming Life or rickpriestley.com. Probably both will get you there. And that's got all the Warlords of Erewhon extra stuff on it, including things like the Omulus.
Which I have enjoyed. Yeah, I have enjoyed those. It was just going up to 2,000 miniatures level that I was trying to figure out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I put those together because I know people would be a bit lost without Omulus, but I'd have to make them cheerful. I think the last one I did, I don't know, I've just posted a couple because somebody sent me a list they'd done for Dark Elves, I think. And it was, I'd not been near the website for well over a year. So I thought, well, can I remember how to do it? It's WordPress. And WordPress updates itself quite often.
I've got it for my business. It's terrible. They're annoying.
Well, If you actually get into the rat run and you know what you're doing, it's fine. But I'm not very technically literate. I've actually built websites from scratch before, but I was using something like Front Page, you know, a long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm okay with things like Adobe InDesign, which is basically something that's a publishing kind of software. I'm okay with because it's sort of familiar concepts to me. But WordPress, it just baffles me sometimes because it's not set up for static websites. You have to kind of throttle it to make it do what you want to do.
Well, I really appreciate you giving me your time and having a little chat about these things. And if you are ever at Boyle and you fancy putting on a special hat and having a quick chat with us there and having a look at all the toy soldiers, do just drop your head in. If you've got a favourite biscuit, let me know and I'll entice you over.
Oh, yes. I'll do anything for a hobnob, you know.
A hobnob. There we go then. Okay. Hobnob. We'll have a hobnob in a golden bowl.
Oh, sounds great. Yeah. Well, I'll try. I hope to try and get over. I didn't actually go this year. I generally go more often than I don't to Boyle, but since Brian died, I felt it was slightly awkward in a way. It's still held at Castle Court, at the courtyard, isn't it?
It was last year, and yeah, and bless Diane, she did a great job, and so did the kids, just putting everything on for everyone. And Garth, as well, did a fantastic job. And hopefully they'll let us have another table for Mr. Matthews. Bedroom Battlefields, and you'll see a massive narrative game again.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'll keep an eye out for that.
Huge thanks to Rick, Jason and Mark for a brilliant conversation, which has sparked a lot of thoughtful and interesting discussion over on the Bedroom Battlefields Discord. If this all resonated with you, please spread the word and share it with your own hobby pals. You'll find the companion article with links to both episodes at bedroombattlefields.com/narrative. That's bedroombattlefields.com/narrative. Alright, that's it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Thanks as always for listening, and we'll catch up again on the next one.